An interview with Professor Frank Ray for the Youngstown State University Project on the History of Youngstown University by Terrence Lynch at 291 Park Avenue, Youngstown, Ohio, on May the 2nd, 1977, at 11 a.m. First, we're going to start with a few questions on your background. What had you done previous before coming to Youngstown State University in terms of education and job experience?
Education, I went to West Virginia Wesleyan. I went to Ohio State, and I finished up at Youngstown in 1949. And I did my graduate work in 1949 and 1950 at the University of Pittsburgh. And job experience, I had my own business in 1931. I went into the wholesale business, wholesale grocery business, and stayed in that until approximately a year before the war started. Then I branched out in other types of business. I was in remodeling, storm sash business when it was new, and while I was teaching, I was experimenting in business with vending process. We went into some new types of vending, working with organizations out of Atlanta. We experimented with selling insurance through vending machines, which has yet not caught on 100%. And I was on different boards, did different advising for different companies. I was connected I was on the New York Board of Trade for 1 year. I was on different organizations here in Youngstown with business connections. Did quite a lot of advising. Since I retired, I had disability, I haven't done a thing, and that's it.
Okay, what year did you come to last year to college?
In January of 1932, I took 3 courses at night.
Was there anything special to college area that played a part in your decision to come to college?
At that time, I had to leave college in my senior year, and I wanted to pick up a few more hours. But with working and all that, I was only stayed in school 1 semester. And I didn't go back to Youngstown until 1947, I think it was. And I finished there in 1949, mostly education courses. Then I went from there to the University of Pittsburgh, then I came back to Youngstown as soon as I finished my master's at Pitt, and I stayed there until I retired.
What was the college like when you first came?
Back in the 30s, there wasn't much college like then because this university was, the Jones Building had just opened in September of 1931, and it was mostly just people taking subjects and to help better themselves. When I went back after the war, it was an awful lot of GI, and it was a different type of college life because everybody was older. Most of the people were taking subject under the GI Bill, we used to figure about 60% of the people were really trying to get something out of it, and 40% was going for the money it received. But the students that really wanted to get something out of it, some of them was older, and they really wanted to make something of themselves. And this was the only opportunity they had. Really worthwhile, I thought. But as I said, there was always a large percentage of them just taking it for the money, which I thought was kind of bad. But you can't stop that anytime.
were the outstanding professors and administrators at the university?
Well, I would say administrators, I would go along with Dean Miller and Dean Smith. And I would say some of my better teachers I had Brown, and Dr. Mayer, and Ralph Baird.
Who were some of the outstanding students at that time?
Well, we had some of the students that I had. Well, I had quite a few students. One of my students, I remember, was president of the bank here in town. I had one of the Roma boys, from Sharon Steele. I had kind of hard to look back, all the different people, but you meet a few of them in business now, and they've gone quite a ways up in business. And I know in business, it's a little different. It takes a long time for them to move up. And it takes about 10, 15 years for a person to move up into a real good job. And most of the students are just coming into that now. And you hear from them, and a lot of times you run into them in different places. Names is kind of hard to remember some of this. Later on, I suppose I'll remember a lot that I can't recall right now.
In what ways is the university today similar to what it was when you first came here?
Similar. Well, similar, no. The closeness is gone. Similar?
Not really.
Nothing is similar now.
In what ways is it different then?
The difference is there's not the closeness. The people are working, everybody, you're referring to the faculty?
Faculty.
Well, the faculty now, I think, is 100% for each other. They aren't for the school. When we was a private university, we did any public, we didn't have to make a speech. In the business school, we wasn't supposed to take anything. And everybody was for the university. They wasn't digging everybody else like they do now. I think the worst thing that ever happened in this university was when the salaries were published and everybody found out what everybody else was making. In my opinion, what I think was the worst thing that ever happened. And because I can remember people that didn't even speak to people for years afterwards. I don't know if they're speaking to one another yet. Mm. And see, there was no salary scare at that time. I think people was paid, I don't think they were paid 100% for what they were worth, but I think a lot of them was. And if they knew the right people, maybe that way helped. And they had the right connections, and was around with the right clip, and was all right. And the board members was all local people, and they was pretty well knew what the faculty member. The faculty was small then. The business school, I think we had 6 people, and the dean, and education department was about the same size, and things like that. So. But now you look at the size of them, the number of chairmen and everything else, and there's not the closeness. For instance, when they used to have a dance, ratio with more faculty members there than there were students. And I think the faculty members had just as much fun as they do now. I guess it's pretty impossible to get faculty members to chaperone dances now.
Right.
And then there was. You always had, you always went to practically everyone there was, if you were a chaplain there wasn't, because everybody seemed to have a good time. Well, I think this kind of slowed up and we got new people in, and some of the people got a little older, and a lot of things changed that way. And I don't know, I said, things have changed, and the students, and I don't think the students have a goal they're trying to reach as much as they were back in the early days. Everybody had something they had in mind, what they wanted to reach when they went to school. And now I don't think they do. I just think they go to school.
Just to go to school.
Go to school.
What role did your family play when you were at the university? Your wife?
My wife and myself, we both went to university together. We graduated together. We graduated from Pitt together. I taught at the university. A few years after that, the wife started to teach at the university. We had two boys, and she started to teach about 5-6 years after I started. She started teaching part-time in the business school, and then she went to the education department. So we've been with the university pretty close for all these years. I know I really enjoy teaching. I taught the things that I knew that better. Business is a field I've been raised in, and I've been around business all 40 to 45 years, 44 years, something like that. And I know even in graduate school, some of the professors would kind of resent some students that had a lot of experience in business. When I was teaching, I used it. I've had students in my class at 70 years old. I used them to ask some questions, talk, tell a little bit about their experience. And I used an awful lot of speakers that connected in the business world. In the last few years, when I was missed a few classes because of being ill, I had a couple people that would take my classes. I had a vice president of Sheeton Tube that would take my classes for me. And I also had other people in business I had no problem getting to bring in. And I also brought them in speaking at certain times. I tried to bring in current things rather than just the basic fact of business, what had gone on before, something, try to get something new. I kept up on all the new things with the date. I went to all different conventions that I could go to, and I knew quite a few people in business. The truth of them, I could keep up on probably an awful lot of things that was going on. I belong to the National Association of Purchasing Agents, and credit and things like that I worked in. And so through that, you get a lot of business people that can help you, and the students use it, get a chance to use it. The funny part of it was that a lot of people who have moved up in organizations, like credit organizations, was there when I was in business. And when I was teaching, they had maybe moved up to the top person in the organization. And I could use them. They would gladly come to class and give you information. And I liked it that way, and I think the students enjoy it. We was fortunate in the business school for years to have mostly teachers that had business experience. Now, it isn't that way. We have a lot of PhDs and no business experience, and they got a lot of theories that I don't know. They aren't practical, and they look good on paper and they sound good and do things like that, but you try to put them into working setup. And I talked to different type of marketing and advertising. In the advertising department, one time, even up until the last year I was there, we only had one professor in the didn't have advertising experience, which made a nice department.
Right.
But what else you want to know?
I think that type of thing would hurt the student coming out of the university, the lack of practical, experience.
And if you don't get a chance to meet the business people, I would have different people in, and we would have, when they went to for a job, for an interview and things like that, they could use this person as a reference to, get in to see somebody, or maybe call them and they would make an appointment for them if they'd heard them talk. And it's surprising that a businessman will sit in class and after we get done speaking, he'll say, who was that fellow, the third person over? Come down and see me when you get out of school. He's interested in the job.
Mm-hmm.
Or somebody asks a sensible question, and you even ask, what's your name? And you remember it. And you say, after class, you say, he's interested, I'll come down and talk to me. And we gave awards in purchasing and for different types of students, and this helped them get jobs. And it opened up the door a lot, that normally they didn't. But you have to have enough basic back experience. Now, your freshman course and your sophomore courses are generally your basic courses. But after that, I think it should be more a theory of what is actually happening, not what might happen, but what is actually going on. Which a lot of teachers that never really get out in the world to know what's going on. And the labor, how to deal with labor. This is a ticklish point with me because I'm non-union. I've dealt with them for many years. And they got their side, you got your side. I do not think a business teacher could be a union person. You can't be in business and be in union both. And I can't see how any teacher can be a member of a union and can teach a class in business and do a good job with the students. I can't see it. And we don't have too many in Youngstown, but we have a few. And those people have never had one day of business experience. I won't even go into some of the things I had to buck with when I was in business. You can burn the tape up a little bit. And the wife told me never to repeat it on the tape, Because actually, you wouldn't believe some of the things that happened in the early days of union, and even some of the things you read, you remember, Doc Five down in the shooting
right.
Field. Well, that was mild, some of the early things that happened, and things like that. So I went through those things, so I know the operation. Now, if you're not management, you can be wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're management, you're on the other side of the fence.
How did you feel when you were chosen to be a member of the Youngstown College faculty?
Well, I really was, I went back to school, mostly I was going to go into secondary teaching, and Dean Miller talked me into going to come on and get my graduate work and come back to teach because I had so much business experience, and he thought I could work in real well. So I practically was assured, not 100% assured of the job when I came back, but I pretty well was. And it was something I wanted to see if I could do. The first teaching I did was in the Army in the Adjutant General School. I taught instead of going to school. And I liked it, so when I got out of the service, I decided I'd like to go into teaching again. And that's how I got it. But I looked at it as something, I was proud to be connected with the university. It was something you worked with, and you worked, try to to get the university to move ahead all the time. He wasn't downgrading it like a lot of teachers do today, professors down there, they run the university down. You wonder why they even teach there, you know. But then everybody seemed to work like a big family. And, well, when the organization get bigger, you don't work that way. But then everybody worked towards the organization. Even towards the last year we were state, it was still pretty much the same way. We had one president. We didn't have any other vice presidents. We had one president, mm-hmm. He was the boss, he ran the thing. And he had the complete say-so. Your deans run the school, and anything you had to do went with the dean. And if it was something too big, then it went to the trippy to the president. And his final say-so was 100%. And there was no board to go through, and what he said went. Now, you had a recourse like you do now, but we didn't have the problems. Jones, President Jones, thought you wasn't doing a good job. He called you and talked to you. Even the dean had talked to you, called you and talked to some of the people. If you got off line a little bit, he talked to you. And today, they can't do too much of that. It's just, I don't know, the people are pretty much with themselves. They're just looking for how much money they made. They don't care. They don't care about it. They don't. I would say 50% of the people teaching today don't care about the students. They don't care if they get a job. They don't care what happened to them. When we was there, we were worried about students. If the job lined up, you'd tell them about it. If something, I don't know, you was a little more conscious of what was going on. But today, a lot of people say it's bigger. Well, nothing bigger. We had classes, 50, 60, 70 students. And you taught 18, 19, sometimes 21 hours. Now you teach 12. So you can't say you didn't do more work, you know what I mean? And then a lot of times you tutor students, like you tutor the football player, the basketball player, and things like that. This was all free gratis. Saturday, we did a lot of that work. Saturday morning, late. And today, if you ask somebody to do the first thing, how much? You know what I mean? Yeah, really, that part. How are we coming?
Okay, we're doing good. What were some of the campus activities on the event, especially in the early days?
In campus activities?
Students and faculty.
Well, there was an offer there. They had a lot of social activity, like dances, which the faculty went to as well as the students. And the departments had parties. We always had a Christmas party, and somebody had a birthday, we had a little bit of a party. And there was more going on. There was just little groups. I belonged to a group that they had somebody from the education department, somebody from the English department, somebody from the history department. And husband and wife was together, and we'd have a dinner, you know, once a month or so. And the faculty did that. And the students would have an awful lot of things going on. Then in June, we always had a faculty baseball game, and the seniors and the faculty, which was a lot of fun. We used to have a brunch, a bear brunch, named after Professor Bear. And it was quite a thing. And all the faculty members, Mrs. Smith used to play, and everybody played, you know. And you could play a couple of innings, come back in a couple of, you know. It was just a lot of fun. And the students and everybody had a lot of fun, just seniors and the faculty. And practically all the faculty members came. You know, not today, you can't get them out for anything, you know what I mean? And, you don't know a lot of students. You know, I was the last couple, 3 years in business school. There's some teachers down there I didn't know. Some I didn't want to know, didn't speak to anyway, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But over the you knew practically everybody on the campus, you know, and you knew an awful lot of students. And I don't know, the everything went, everybody seemed to go to, you know what I mean? You didn't have to push. basketball games, students went to it better than they do now. Football games, they went to better than they do football. And a lot of things like that. But faculty and the students seem to went to it a lot better. And I don't know, it's anything that went on at the campus, most of President Jones and the deans and everybody went to it. It was practically, it wasn't required to go, everybody wanted to go, you know what I mean? It was something you afford to enjoy it, you know what I mean? And the fraternities, I helped work with some fraternities when they were getting started. Dean Gillespie helped me help CPT when they got started. I think I was the only CPT, I was the fifth CPT in the United States who appointed a member. And the last one appointed, number four, was the one member in the Supreme Court. And I was the fifth one who appointed a member, not an associate member, because of the work I did for getting them started. I had that time you had your two religious organizations, your Catholics and your Protestants. The Jewish people didn't have anything. It was non-Jewish, but Jack figured I could get it organized and pull a few strings to get it around. So we got a national in 1 year.
This is in the early 50s.
Yes, and we worked hard on that, getting that deal through. And so the fraternities had a lot of parties, and some of the things wasn't, you know, what it's supposed to be, you know, but they was kept pretty much. The big project that I wanted that they voted me down on, back in the early 50s, I wanted the university to take over, look over, and put all the fraternity houses down there.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought I was nuts. It eliminated a big parking problem. They could all walk. And they'd have control of the fraternity houses. Now, Duke University had the fraternities all in one place. Practically all of them, not all of them, practically all of them, was all on one big section, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Right next to the university. It eliminated the driving problem, you know what I mean? Well, they thought I was nuts. They could have bought those houses down there that for $5,000 and $6,000 and $7,000, you know, what they were now. And then that would have been access to the playground, which would have been a recreation down old Harrison Field. Now they put that other one down, it'd been ideal if they'd have bought. Now you can't buy those houses, what? You know what they'd be worth now. But they all thought I was nuts on the deal. But most of the attorneys, they moved far, so they all have to drive to school class. You know, it's a long walk.
Mm-hmm.
That made the parking problem that much worse. But they had them down there. They could walk up the hill, you know, but no problem. And you'd have a little bit better control. You know, I mean, they'd all been together, one of kind of almost together. But I was advisor in another fraternity before that. I helped them get started. And
which one was that?
I forget which one it was now. I got in a hustle from it. We wanted to raise enough money on a raffle. And back in those days, we could sell a raffle. That was right after the war. And we wanted a raffle off a car. And we could have made about $100,000 because everybody would buy tickets. And we got it okay from the dean Smith and a few people. And then all went to somebody in the fraternity decided they didn't want to work a little bit. So we had about 1,000 tickets sold, we had to refund it. And before we could get them out, you know what I mean? But so I said, look, you know, like my idea, get somebody else to advise you. And then the university then passed a rule which couldn't have any lotteries. But we really got it in before, he said. Mm-hmm. And I knew the mayor then, Chuck Henderson was the mayor, and I got permission from him to sell downtown free Saturdays. So we had everything planned. We had free Saturdays, and we allowed to sell downtown. We allowed to sell the raffles downtown. And we also had We had permission from the Board of Education to work the football games, the high school football games, at the games. And, you know, for 50 cents a ticket back after the war, they just throw the money away. You don't remember before your time, they bought anything because they had so much money after the war to spend, and they bought anything you could sell. University of Pittsburgh sold, gave away a car, what paternity gave away a car over there, and they made $125,000 on one car. $125,000 on one car. I know this to be pretty wrong, but a true fact. And they didn't run it long at all. They didn't run it long at all. They even reprinted tickets so many times that we're ashamed. This is one thing that they could do. You could do them, but now you can't. Then all your fraternity was running, giving turkeys away, things like that. You know, selling raffles on turkeys, right? So we decided to have this real big raffle. So I told them beforehand, I'd get all the information where we could sell it. So I made a few telephone calls to people I knew. And this wouldn't allow me to give you permission. So we had captain in the groups divided up where we was going to work and what day they work and what football games they would work and everything. They had everything set up. And some group come in and they voted it down. And I resigned that night. I said, well, and they, I forget which fraternity it is now, they went national after that. So then they were all locals. And right. some of them were just going national. And when I gave them to CBT, he said practically everything was national then. And so they moved in pretty fast. And it was, they had, when the CBT's head that time, they had one fella who was an organizer. He really was an organizer. We had him as president for 2 years in a row. And he was really an organizer. And he came into play pretty good. And but he had some good students. I think he had some good students. And most of the students are good students. And we got an offer from the boys from Pittsburgh for 1 year. They came up here and get the ZBTs. And they go to Penn State or Pittsburgh University. And there was a member of the ZBT. They went to Pittsburgh, they couldn't get in. So it was their problem to try to keep me here for a couple of years, he said. And we got a lot of Pittsburgh students. Well, they liked it here. Well, some of them were here for a year, they leave, and they come back, you know, after being away a year. They liked it better than they were. So we got to let quite a lot of students here. But you know what fraternity we all fraternity? Which one belong to?
Sigma Phi Epsilon.
Who's that at?
It's on Indiana now. It used to be on Bryson Street.
It used to be on Bryson Street.
Right across from where the jam bar is.
I know where
it is. It was Phi Sigma Epsilon in the early 50s. Mm-hmm. Well, from 31 to 54.
My boy belongs to up here on Bryson. I mean, on Park Avenue up here, second floor.
Bryson is a captain.
That part of it.
Mm-hmm. What was the campus like when we first came here? In terms of structure of the campus, buildings?
When I was there, first started there, it was Jones Hall, period.
That was in the 30s.
Uh-huh. And when I came back in the war, after the war, we had a lot of barracks. And the library was built about that time, you know, around that time. And then we had all the barracks, and we had an old stable was converted in, and we had a home there.
West of all.
Then we used the public library, classrooms there. Then we had the Todd Hotel, we used rooms downstairs. And that was an experience to teach down there, in the basement. And you taught rats, and they'd run around the pipes at the top where class was on, you know. If you're afraid of rats, you didn't teach there. And then then buildings started springing up around it to raise money. President Jones, his method of building was that he didn't build until he had the money raised, not promised, but raised in the bank. And so our building program was always secure because the money was there and the building was paid for when it was finished, so we had no problem. But it was a slower problem. But we would move fast enough. We were moving as fast as we could, you know what I mean? They, at one time, in the, around 54, 55, they thought the university would level off about 4,500 to maybe 5,000, somewhere around there. I thought they were wrong, which I turned out to be right later. And then they started that big movement. Actually, the number of students that we have now and we had when we went state is about the same. Now, the difference is that you have a graduate program now that you didn't have, and you have a two-year program that you didn't have. So you look at your program then and figure, well, it's just straight a four-year course, and we have practically the same amount of students, you see. And the teachers that we had was, as I said, were more dedicated to the setup. And we say, well, you didn't have quality teachers because you didn't have PhDs. But the PhD structure was, I think it's a wonderful structure, but when they give you 1 year to go from 17% to 51% PhD, you don't get the cream of the crop. You get anything to walk down the street with a paper, you know what I mean? And you hire them, and you get stuck with them. And you're still stuck with
them. So what happened?
That's right. That's what happened. We had 17% PhD. We didn't have a PhD in the business department. Dr. T, he had a PhD in library science.
Mm-hmm. Who's this?
Dr. Tulesky. And that was the only PhD we had in the business department.
Hmm.
And so we had to get 51% PhD. So you can see what we got.
Is this in 60?
When we went state.
67.
Went state. The state gave us 1 year to bring up a PhD requirement. Now, most of the time in businesses, when I was going to school in the late 40s, there was no way of getting a PhD in business. You could take it in econ. That is not business. I have a teaching field in econ too. That's not business, that's a theory. Business is the actual practice. That's my opinion of the two. And so I could have went on at that time, but master's was all I needed. And so that's where long we went. And then in late years, they started stretching out, started giving business degrees, and then they started giving business degrees to some of these foreign students that come over with the idea of going back to Iran and a few places like that. And they got married and stayed over here. And we've had some pistols, and they're still around. But anything else I can help you with?
Was there anything in terms of discipline codes or dress codes?
Yes. Yes. I can remember when in summer school we'd have students that would come in from other schools, and the girls would go out to wear shorts and things like that in other schools. And so therefore they wore them then. But the discipline code was real strict, and which I thought was good. Now in business school, the dean was real strict on it because we tried to explain to the students that you dress like you would want somebody to be working for you, or if you figured you went to look for a job, and you didn't come sloppily dressed or anything like that. We used to try to say to the students, say, now look, you never know when somebody from the important concern is going to walk in someday, you're going to run in the class. And your appearance to him is, that first impression is a lasting impression, you know what I mean? And so for a long time, we didn't have the problem that some of the other departments had, even though it was pretty strict. And they required the faculty members to dress. We were required to wear a tie, a coat, and which I agreed with 100%. I agreed with 100%. I I never in my life have ever went to a business place or ever taught a class about tie on or about a coat. I never took my coat off in class either. And it's just a matter of heat. It's just what you, if you think it's hot, it is hot. If you think it's cool, it is cool. And it's in my imagination, I think it's more imagination than people think it gets too hot. They have to take the coat off and the tie off. And, well, I've seen professors with you can set a poor example for faculty members, that part of it.
Anything else on the dress codes or discipline you'd like to say?
What was that?
The discipline codes, anything else?
They was real strict there. The students had a recourse to, mm-hmm. They could go before a committee. If you asked a student to leave your class, you could go before a committee and reinstate them. I ever remember one student ever being reinstated. The committee was fair. Most of the time, the professors put up with, you know, they set the person down, and then they didn't leave. Mm-hmm. I remember a few years ago, I tossed a student out of my class, and about 12 hours from graduating, he was taking 6 from me, and I tossed him out of both classes. And so he went to the dean, and he raised him. The dean backed me up, even a little older backed me up. And so the dean asked him to throw him out of school. So I am pretty sure the student never came back in 12 hours.
What did he do? What did he do?
Well, he didn't come to class. And we was taking a test every 2 chapters, because the course was tough. And he was taking a course on the conference plan to take it, and I didn't want to give it to him, but I got pulled him into it. And he never turned any of his papers in. And he came in about 3 weeks before the semester was over and wanted to know what he had to do. And mm-hmm. I said, well, you've already got the course. And I said, the course, you already come into class once in a while. I said, you've missed so many tests now. I said, you've already flunked that. So he raised the room of class. I said, you can leave now. So he left. I went over to see the dean, and when the argument came up, and the dean just threw him out of school. And he never had taken a recourse on it after, but if you let him get away from everybody else, then you're going to lose. And so the dean always required us to put out the first day what we wanted and our requirements. And it was up to us to hold it. Usually you would like 2 cuts for the semester, that's what you would allow. If you didn't care if they missed more than that, it's up to you. But if you wanted to mark them 1 grade down, that's the way you could do it. But you told them the first day, and that's what they did. So you had no problems after that. And then you held to what you told them you were going to do, the number of tests you were going to give, how the grading system was, and that's why. Now, I don't believe in grading on a curve, because I mostly tell seniors. And with some juniors and seniors, I taught mostly purchasing tools that I have some advanced courses. And mostly seniors, so you can't grade on a curve, because I think people are screened out by then. So you get a lot of high grades, you know, you get a lot of A's and a lot of B's. So I would tell them, I get so many A's, so many B's. And anybody below this will get C's, or maybe D's, you know. Because you get very few F's, you get an F if they have missed too many classes, automatic, you know. But, so I always graded in numbers. I never graded in A, B, C's to the final grade. So you knew where you stood. You had an average of an 89 or a 91, and somebody else had a 92 average, somebody else. 87. So you knew just about where the average was and where you stood. And then you knew some maybe 8 A's in the class, and maybe 10 B's, and a couple C's, out of 20 or so in the class. So you had no argument. she can do. Because if they was helping somebody, if they was hurting themselves.
The competition
was there. And after a while, they wise up to the effect, you know what I mean? Now, cheating in my classes, I never had much of a problem with it. Some of the students, you know, they sat in the back of the room, and most of the time I put out two tests or maybe three tests. If they wanted a copy of the guy next to them, wouldn't say a test anyway. So it didn't mean anything to them. And so I remember one time, put over in the cafeteria after a test, and the person asked me a question, and I said, well, I don't know. I said, there was three tests now. There were a few people around the table that day. I had about four people who didn't come back to class the next day, they quit. But cheating, you can't just give them the paper and watch it, but you have little things that you do. And I tried never to leave my test out. I gave the test, didn't even put a name on it, used it in a number system. And I would give them the test back by numbers. I didn't have paper on it. Didn't know whose paper I was grading. And when I picked them up, they put the name on it. Then I knew who the paper was. And that way, I never had a problem with people. So Larry knew we had a couple of girls in the class he did, and knew who the grade was. Yeah. Well, this way I didn't know who their paper was. And because I'd mix up the numbers and hand them out anyway, you know what I mean? So I never knew who the paper was. Only with one person could you make a remember. You'd give them two tests that day, you wouldn't remember the number anyway, you know. Maybe for a while you might think you knew it. But I thought that was a pretty fair way of testing, and you didn't have the problem with cheating. You still always have a few people that tried a few things. Then you report, you just had term papers and things like that. A lot of times you have to look at some paper, and you generally sometimes remember the ones you had like it before, and you try to remember the paper it was. And so, I don't know, it's, you try to pick subjects sometimes that you haven't used before, and this helps. It soon you run out before long. I always remember the time that Ed Riley, a little person with a pretty good term paper, and I was like, don't you? It's a pretty good and I turned it in. He got it to turn the house. He copied and everything left the name on it. Robin.
And he was going to use the paint.
And he took it in hand. George, you know, I think yeah, like I should be able to give up. But at least you should make a few changes in it. I've seen people that like turn their notebook to even scratch a person's name out and put another person's name in it. But I used to grade my notebooks and I marked my ads sometimes ink that, you know, you'd have to look real close to see it. You know, you would pick it up and you look real close. And to get around that, you can require current ads too, you know, and that helped the situation. It eliminated an awful lot of problems you had otherwise.
What do you think were your major contributions to the college?
My major contribution? Passing on a lot of the business experience I had and trying to explain how it could be used in current business and like, and maybe how to, I hired an awful lot of people. I owned my own business. I hired a lot of people, and I worked with, when I was in graduate school, I worked in personnel and did an awful lot of job training and things, which I passed on a lot of people, little things to look for, and little techniques that I picked up over the years in business. And also, some of the things that was passed on to me from other college professors, because they would pass on, that I thought was worthwhile, you know, it was good and it still could be used. And I try to advise students in some of the things that they maybe should look for when they get out, the little techniques about changing jobs and how to go for an interview and how to or ask for certain things without offending the person. Different techniques that I knew that didn't offend me when they asked for certain things. And never, the one thing that I always tried to explain to a business student, when he goes for a job, to know as much about the corporation that he's going for, so he can at least talk sensible. The worst question I ever heard, the person being interviewed, and he asked a man what they manufactured. So these are the things that you should never make that kind of mistake, you know. And you say, well, they don't, but you'd be surprised how many screwy questions that people will ask, you know. But another thing that I try to get people to look at both sides of the union question, more so than most people did, but I had been exposed to it more than most people, and I tried to explain, I passed it on to an awful lot of people, and because, as I said, the people that you was teaching, they was raised in a union family, and all they could see was one side of the question, so you had to do it in a way that you didn't offend them. You had to go about it in a way that didn't offend them. And I can remember one student that he argued with me for 3 years. Then the fourth year, he came around to my way of thinking. Now, I thought to myself, well, I achieved something that I didn't achieve anything. His dad got fired, lost his job in the mill, they closed down the mill. And the union contract was, they closed that mill down. Those people went back to the laborers. They didn't force somebody on some other mill, like a 20-inch mill went down, closed down. The whole group went back, all the way back to nothing. That's the way the contract was. And here the dad had 30 years in. And
he's on the labor gang.
Back to the labor gang. So then he was on my side. And I thought, before that it was, I tried not to offend too many people with that, but if they'd gone to management, they had to see the other side of the question. I know I tried to explain to them one day that at that time, U.S. Steel was carrying 39 lawyers that did nothing but union contracts. Now you figure the cost of that. A building by itself, and they'd easily have at least one secretary, or maybe two, and all the other things, imagine what the cost would be. Now, 39 lawyers don't come cheap. And then legal secretaries don't come cheap either. And the run of the secretary would be so bad, you know. Mm-hmm. And then your building and all the equipment they would have and all the files. And they said, why do they need that money? Well, in purchasing, I used to explain if they would want to make a product rather than buy it. They were going to deal with two new unions, to forget it. They were only going to deal with one new union, right? But as soon as there's only two or more new unions coming in, forget about making it because the cost was immediately out. They didn't need to go any farther than figure that. And a few times I got an argument on it. And I said, well, just stop figuring. X-ray help. Even to the cost of when the IBM come in and change your whole bookkeeping system to put a new tab on everything, you know, and I just broke the whole thing down to explain what the cost was. And I said, I'm just getting started, you want any more? And I said, no, once you gotta do this twice, every time get a new union again. And I said, you get another lawyer expense. I said, well, maybe your lawyer, you gotta do some more work than he can handle, or at least another clerk on. Person won't be in. And then I said, you have all the other things you have to have. Your executive, the handling of making your public relations man, will need an assistant to handle this deal. The labor relations man, our public relations department. And I said, we haven't got started yet on what you're buying equipment to get it. And they would kind of look at it a little bit. I did this at a business meeting. I think it was in Cleveland, or Akron. And I made that statement, and a few people looked at me for a while, and they asked a few questions. And then a few people come up and started giving their experience of what they had, what the costs had increased, and buying, making a product equipment, and the buying concern, and that part of it.
Is there anything that you'd like to have changed in the university or the present compared to the state university compared to the college? Is there anything
I'd rather see it run locally instead of being run by state. Mm-hmm. Locally, you would have you could fit your subjects more to fit the student you have in this area, and you wouldn't have. You could actually train the people that would like jobs in this area. This is a peculiar section. There's so many students through this area want to stay right in Youngstown or Warren. They don't want to move. Mm-hmm. And now our business field now more trained for the broad job. Something here and something there. Well, we used to do more things like we used to bring speakers in from the steel companies, and we used to bring speakers in from this company and that company. There were more local ideas, and we could train them. Now, since we went state, the setup is more of a broad setup, and we got a couple different fields that we normally didn't. And then again, a teacher that we have to hire. We have to hire a person with more book experience, and we can hire a businessman. I think a person that works for a concern and goes up to through the management field at the age of 55 or 56 decides he wants to quit working, and maybe he's had a degree, and maybe he's a master. He can give more to a student than some guy who went through college and got a PhD and never had a day experience. I remember a few years ago, we wanted to hire a professor that came out of the American car out of Masonry. Ed Rodney and myself appointed the dean to hire him. Well, the dean didn't want to hire him, but he had been general manager and retired. And we thought he was real sharp. Well, the irony of the thing was, the faculty meeting, the day before school started, I had a heart attack. And I hired him to teach my classes. I hired him myself. Mm-hmm. And about the third day, he taught classes. Some of the students came up to my wife and wanted to know where I run into this guy. He was so hard. The fifth day, they got a petition to the dean to get the dean down to hire him. Mm-hmm. And so the dean hired him. And we talked to Manny to get his master's. He worked on his master's at Canada back when I was a good bitch. And then he was so sharp in his field. It was all in his head. He'd tell all this in life, And they was giving him, most of the department head didn't want him in the department because he was too sharp. He was too sharp. And so he was also teaching at Penn State, probably at the extension school in Sharon. So they were giving him a rough time. So Penn State put him in charge of the school over there. He left Youngstown, which we lost a good teacher. I know when I retired, he wanted me to come over there and teach, but I couldn't because I had a disability. What he could give the students, you couldn't get out of a book. For instance, some students ask, and sometimes now we have a strike, what did management do? How do they do to line up the business and how they hold these customers and what do they do. The book don't tell you how to do this. This is something you have from experience. And you say, well, we send somebody there and we explain how long we think this bike is going to do. Or then you can transfer it to one of our other companies for 20 days late being shipped in, or something like that. You know, which they don't. The book don't do you anything. You don't get this. But under the requirement now, then when somebody has a PhD and they've got something in the book that somebody wrote that happened in 1940 or 1950, and today you'd go broke if you use a method. And this is because business is so changing now. The best example of the Fonzie of making this new change in the advertising program. Like an old course, I went up the other day and talked to the manager. Talked to him about an advertising. They asked him a few questions about what they thought. Just thinking what was going to work and everything, something he'd never been tried before, things like that. And I told him, I think it looks good, but I said, you want to educate the people because the people have been so used late to coupons, you see. So this is a new change, you see. So this is the thing that you don't learn out of a book, you see. And this is a big thing about it. I'm mostly talking business school, most of my time there. Yeah. Now your computers are so big. Where you going, babe? Come on in. Come here.
Anything more on what you'd like to have changed in your
show? Well, I think that, I don't know, I kind of always liked the semester system over the quarter system. Because the semester system gave you a long time to get things put together. Quarter system, you seem to rush everything through. I know, for instance, if you have a term paper, it takes you 2 or 3 weeks to get the assignments all made, and 3 weeks off of 10 weeks or 11 weeks, you get some, and all you do is pick up the term papers at the end. You don't have a chance to discuss them in class and have them read in class. Normally, I used to like to pick out the best term papers and have them read in class. Mm-hmm. I remember the last year that I taught, I had manager of one of the big malls here, and I had some paper that read, you know, so I had her read her paper. So she was walking the mall the whole life, you know, managing the mall, one of the big malls here, Eastwood out here. And boy, the experiences she gave, you couldn't get out of a book. Now, if I had to push the stuff ahead, and I knew what paper to pick out, you know, I knew her, because, you know, and so I had that information. So, you know, I kind of like a semester system, but some people like the quarter system. It turns over faster, and you don't have the students so long, and they think it don't drag so much, and there's all that 2 weeks break at Christmas time, if you know, they say you lose everything at Christmas time. I can remember back when we first started, the dean used to require us to get a big assignment over Christmas time. Dean Miller used to give maybe a counting problem to take 7 or 8, 9 hours to work over, maybe 2 people to work on it. And so if they wanted to do something like that, but some of us, we figured out we'll let the student have a vacation, you know. As I said, when we was a private, we'd be free what we could do, you know what I mean. We would state they required you to write out everything which you would teach, and you couldn't change anything. And you had to have everything written down, and you just followed it, you know, just like, well, actually, you can't follow a lot of things, you know, sometimes, because some things turn up, and you watch a class, and they're getting it, they aren't getting it, and you have to change what's going on. You sit up in front of the class, you can tell if what you're talking about is going over or not going over. It is going over. And you change your approach, you go into it a little bit different. And under the setup they have now, the time schedule don't give you a chance to make any changes. You go so fast, they get it. All right. Now, that's the way you're supposed to teach in college. You're supposed to not even worry about the student if you don't get it. But actually, I don't know, I always looked at it, I always felt if they wasn't getting it, it was a lot my fault. I used to think if I had a bad test, it was my fault. Not as much as it was theirs, they wasn't getting it, I wasn't putting it across enough for them. Now if the grades was all in, maybe all in the 70s, I would just put that much across. It was all in the 80s, that's how much I was putting across. And so, as I said a while ago, I don't believe I'm grading on a curve, not a standard curve. You have your own curve in your own mind, which you put in. But under the requirement now, you have to do it a certain way, you have to turn in all the things. It's taken the freedom away from teaching, I think, an awful lot. And it don't allow the teaching well. I do think that the state figures they got a bunch of kooks teaching anyway, and they have to line them up and herd them around like a bunch of cattle, tell them what they can do and what they can't do. And that, I agree, they have something like that. If you don't tell them what they should teach, it's just too bad. I can remember one time we had a student taking a class from a professor that had business, and another professor that never had a business course. The student was a graduating senior, and 3 weeks before graduation, he found out he was taking the same class from two different professors. Yeah. And the only way he found out that one professor had a speaker in and had the two classes together, and he found out he was taking the same class. And we got together and talked about it, and the dean said, "We should give credit, because one fellow used the book, read word for word out of the book, and the other fellow didn't even use the book. He used nothing but his own experience." He was a promoter, you know. My editor, named Whitelock. I got him to come down to the university to teach. I was in business with him for a while. Chaplain, a pretty good friend, he's a promoter now. He's down in Florida, Miami. And he knew his subject, you know. The university had him out all speaking and everything else. And he was pretty sharp. He was really sharp and set up. Now, these type of people now, they don't need the teaching because they don't have a doctorate degree and they don't have this. Mm-hmm. But they can teach you more in 1 week than so many people can on book learning. I looked at some of the setup that he works in the mortgage business under, and I myself have an awful lot of problems with the IRS, and I was kidding him. I said, "How do you get away with some of the things that you do?" Well, he said, "I get down and I lie it out with them what I'm going to do and say, now this is what I'm going to do, what do I have to do to make it legal before I get started?" And that's how he does it. And, he set up a lot of things around the university, and I know myself, we had this one professor who used to teach, before he went to class, how to teach co-insurance before he had it with the class, so he could teach the students. I won't tell you the teacher, he's still teaching, but we'd explain it to him so he could read it off in class. And you know, co-insurance is if you're in a business, you wouldn't understand it very, you know, because he was telling the class, you take insurance from three different companies and have a fire and you make money out of two of them, and you don't. Because co-insurance is if I had permanent co-op, you know, and you have to do it that way. And a percentage of them, things like that. And so, oh, even. And so we used to get together and write it out for him so he could read it in class. Well, he was, he's still teaching. Jackie left, and we had these are the things that I think that the students are losing. The students are losing because they don't get these people that are a big success. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. These people that are a big success. You know what I mean? Because you take a fellow that starts out with nothing in 4 or 5 years, lives like, for instance, at maybe $200,000, $300,000 home, and really living up, and have done it on a legitimate setup, but you know, not any rackets or anything, but strictly on knowing how to get around certain things, tax problems and things like that. And I know the big problem with the university down here, it kept growing all along with the college, the YMCA school under the college, and it became a university, and it became a state university, and all the stages you went through. I was accredited school one time before that, it wasn't accredited, and then there were temporary setup and all those stages you went through. Well, you have to go through all these things. Now, all the work we did and all the buildings they built, everything, you get them all built, and then they turn it all over to the state. And the state reaped all the harvest of it. Mm-hmm. And all the hard work has been done. You see, now it's just the idea of holding the students. And this is, a lot of people say this is a hard job. Well, it shouldn't be, because the facilities they got now, and compared to the facilities that we had a few years back, the only thing that we had to offer a few years back that they didn't have now, especially in the business school, was professors that really had the business experience. You know, some of the professors were quick at the university because of some of the regulations, you know. Maybe know some of them were quick. And that's some of those that I brought in. I know, for instance, Mr. Gutnick, I brought in from Homestead by Thompson. He quit a few years ago because he was good. And know what the background he had. Mm-hmm. And then Fortunato quit here again a couple of years ago, too. The background he had. It's, the whole world of the red tape with the other stuff. And of these people that they piled under because they got a PhD. See, my wife has a PhD, so I can't, But in her field, it's a difference. It's been in education. It strictly is a book learning.
Right.
It's a little more experience, you know what I mean? But it's strictly a book learning on that side. But some of the things I think, if they're going to have to go back if they want the business students to get. Take a baby and come out and get some experience, you know what I mean? Because we got a few guys down there that, I don't know, but it's a shame that some of the things they tell some of the students in class, you know what I mean? And things like that. I used to argue with them when I was down there, they'd write one answer on my test, which would be right, and they'd give the same answer on another test, and it would be wrong. The professor said, well, this is what they do in India. But that's all argument, you know. What they do in Iran, you know. I mean, what the hell do we care what they do in Iran? That's a scandal over here. But those are the people that are getting the pay, and those are the people that are running the place set up now. They got a fellow now running what used to be general business that hardly can speak English. Dr. T in the class for, had the department for a while, and Dr. T was bad enough, you know what I mean? But he had a PhD, so they had to give him, he was the only PhD he had, you know what I mean? But he had a library science degree, and he had some econ, but didn't have no business experience whatsoever. He's a nice guy, don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. He knows his library science, he knows econ, but business, no. And this guy they got now. Some of the other things, I can say a lot now because I'm out of the setup, even my last year that I taught, I've been pulling some punches on some teachers that I thought would actually hurt in the university, what in the university any good. But they got themselves in there and you can't get them out, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And to fire a PhD, an impossibility. Then they get in too long, they got 10 years, then you can't get them out. You see what I mean? You can't get them out. And you say, well, the dean would like to get them, but he can't get them. They got a PhD. And then they get 10 years, then what can you get to burn the school down to get them out? And the method of tenure I used to like before, in the department, the tenure was this way. When you got so much time in, and your tenure come up, the head of the department went around to everybody in the department that had tenure and got a vote from us. Do you think we should vote him in or vote him out? Not vote him in this year. You didn't get voted in, you didn't get voted in. Now, the people that knew was the people in the department. Not in the school, but in that department. And the dean had the final okay on top of it, just say to me, which I thought was the right way. And now it's just a matter of a little bit of nothing, you know what I mean? And I can remember when they used to give some people some tough times and give them tenure, and now pretty much in a routine set up. And then this new deal that hurt the university, especially the business school, not so much the university as a whole, but the business school, on this 65 age if they have to retire. This is the thing is going to really hurt the business school more than anything else. Because we're going to lose teachers that have just come up in the prime of business, you know what I mean? For instance, you get a man that's 60 years old and maybe 62 or he's in business, you tell him to come and teach him. And he knows he'll teach for a couple of years. What the hell, he's going to come and teach. But if he can teach, and he likes to teach, you know what I mean? And he can teach maybe until he's 70 years old, take his test every year after he's 65, and his memory equipment. He's given more to them than what some joker that read in the book that we wrote in 1950, you know what I mean? And I know I had an argument with a professor one time in school, and arguing about a book, and he says, if I didn't use the book, what should we do? I said, read the first two chapters and the fundamental thing, and then throw the book away and use magazine articles. And he couldn't believe it, you know. I said, the book is an antique. And you know where I was? At Ohio State. Yeah. And you know who the professor was? Beckman, from Ohio State, the head of the department, just retired. I was just then. Mm-hmm. I was just young man, and it was a marketing book, and I told him the book was an antique. He wrote the book, and I told him the book was an antique, and I explained it to him in class, and I used the illustrations of three gentlemen from the best room, which were Owen Hickman and Squires, with personal friends of mine and my friends and my family, and he used them as illustrations, and the illustration he used was so wrong. And I remember one weekend I was home and they was visiting my family. Hickman was over, Hickman and his wife was over. So I was talking to him about it, you know what I mean? So I went back that Monday. And so I got in an argument with him as usual. And he said, where's your authority from? I said, I was talking to Mr. Hickman last weekend. And he said, this is what they are doing now, you know. And then I explained the whole setup of what he had in his book. Oh, you know, I feel real regret in the course. But everybody learned something in the class. He was a professor, and he never missed one class. Normally at a state university, they have a lot of assistant professors, instructors in teaching the class when they don't show up and don't come. But he never missed that class. But I've had students in my class disagree with me, and it never offended me. I asked them to explain it, why, and give them reason, and things like that. And they had a good logical point, but I couldn't even get the reason for it. Now, in purchasing, there's so many different ways of going about it in industrial purchasing. And I remember I had a fellow from Automatic Sprinkler gave me an argument one day. And after we got all done, it's fine. I said, you have a problem that other companies don't have. And I explained his problem, what they had that other companies didn't have. And I said, this is the only way you can do it. And then you could see it, you know what I mean? But for a while, a lot of professors panicked, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I knew the company real well. So I had them at a disadvantage, but I knew the operation pretty well. I used to use them a lot for speakers and send students down to interview people there and things like that.
Okay, wrap it up. Is there anything else you think important that you'd like to add that I haven't covered? Since anything you generally like to say about the university that hasn't been covered here? You know, how it was back in the 50s and the 40s, like the quality of the students, has that changed any?
Or how they control students?
Right.
Well, I don't think so. I think it's pretty much the same. As I said a while back, that the control of your class is up to you 100%. You have the complete say-so of the class. And if you put a person out of the class, he has no recourse but to go to a committee to get back in again. And so this hasn't changed any. And I think the control, now the what goes on in the campus, everything like that, I think it's a lot better now than it was a few years back when a lot of this unrest was on. This was something that was going through, and it was peculiar. Some of the teachers was in favor of what was going on, and some of the teachers wasn't. I know at that time, Pugsley was president at that time, and if he had had his way, we would have had a lot less...